Book session number 4384, reel 9.
For this infantry regiment, both captured at Mons in August 1914. The third man, a Belgian civilian, had given them refuge when they escaped early in 1918. Took them back to battalion headquarters. Started ahead with my guns when I was stopped by Major Craig, our temporary brigade commanding officer, who showed me a copy of an order from Canadian Corps headquarters, which read about as follows. Hostilities will cease at 11 hours, November 11th. Troops will stand fast on the line reached at that hour. There will be no intercourse with the enemy. Signed, General Sir Arthur Currie, Canadian Corps. No guns were to enter Mons, so I pulled to the side of the road on the front side of a sign reading Friends on one side and Mons on the other. General Currie made his formal entry into Mons at 2 p.m. November 11th, escorted by a squadron of lancers and a battery of the Royal Canadian Horse Artillery. Equipment and men were spotless and polished. After they had passed, one of my men said, "Where go the tin soldiers?" We joined the battery and after dinner moved through Mons to a position behind the armistice line. Next morning, a series of explosions wakened us. A Belgian civilian found a number of boxcars unguarded and set them on fire. They were loaded with trench mortar bombs. Some of these exploded. We did move to another location to get away from unexploded bombs lying around. We stayed here for about a month. During this time, we were reviewed by King Albert of Belgium, and I had a three-day leave to Brussels. Found the German marks accepted in Brussels at their face value of 25 cents. Fortunately, I had kept over 3,000 marks picked up on August 8th. These early new notes I managed to convert to used currency of smaller denominations. Enjoyed my stay, but when I got back to Mons, found that the brigade had moved out on a march to the line. My horses and groom had been left behind, caught up with the battery about noon the following day. Supply problems caused the 3rd Division to transport our brigade to the 4th Division. We moved into billets in the small town of Great Russell, about 25 miles southwest of Brussels. Great Russell, near the center of the 1915 German invasion path, did not show any sign of damage, and we heard no tales of atrocities. People were very hospitable. Our men were billeted in houses and offices in larger homes. Horses were in stables for the first time. The 24th Battery Officers' Mess was in the home of the postmaster. My billet across the road from the post office was in a large home of a Dutch citizen named De Kuyper, a member of the well-known Horn Gin family. He had married a Belgian countess. It was good to sleep in a rear bed with clean sheets and to eat meals seated at a table. Routine activities such as stables, exercise rides, guard at the guns, and daily roll calls were only duties. The section commanders attended to these. My assignment each fourth day was mounted messenger between brigade headquarters of the 4 batteries. Brigade headquarters was in a chateau a mile or so from each battery. Messages were very few, so got in some games of bridge with Colonel Stewart and his staff. Men were given leave to go to Liège or Brussels one day each second week. Most went to Liège first, where they could buy German marks for 90 centimes, and spend them later in Brussels at 125 centimes. Transport transportation was by narrow gauge trains for steam locomotives. About mid-December, I went to Brussels for 3 days' leave. Arrived about 10 a.m. on a Sunday. Asked a Wild West gentleman how to get to the Palace Hotel using my best French. He gave me his answer in excellent French, but in perfect English, he told me that I did not need to speak French in Brussels. During the German occupation, the Belgians gathered in groups to learn to speak English. The Germans limited them to no more than 4 persons in a room. So meetings were held, 4 per room, in as many rooms as possible, per house. Brussels was used throughout the war as a rest area for German officers and men, and as the only wartime capital fully lighted and undamaged during the war. The gentleman I met was an architect named Blow. He invited me to tea that afternoon where I met his family. His son escorted me around the following day, visited the art gallery, saw a number of paintings, chiefly by Rubens and some by others. The Palace of Justice, the Cathedral of Gideon, and various parks. His call to brigade headquarters where Colonel Stewart handed me a type citation which reads as follows. December the 22nd, 1918, to Lieutenant J.E. Sutton, N.C. This officer was in command of a section of 18-pounder CF guns, which was attached to the 4th C&R Battalion on October the 9th, during the operations which resulted in the capture of Cambrai. He displayed great boldness and initiative in pushing forward on a reconnaissance through the town with the infantry patrols, and took his section of guns through Cambrai into a position on the southeastern edge of the town as soon as the first bridge capable of carrying field guns was constructed. About 17:30 on that day, the enemy opened up with heavy shelling by 15-centimeter howitzers on the area of Cambrai Citadel. Lieutenant Sutton's gun teams were standing by in this area. This officer, by his splendid courage, maneuvered his teams through the streets to safety without casualties. His example was an inspiration to all ranks. Throughout all recent operations, this officer has shown the same spirit of daring and initiative. Awarded the Military Cross, Canadian Corps, NS 21-13-136-18. Please accept my hearty congratulations. Signed, J. Crosley Stewart, Lieutenant Colonel, commanding 8th Army Brigade, Canadian Field Artillery, 22-12-18. Christmas dinner was served to all members of the brigade in the schoolhouse. Roast beef, Yorkshire pudding, potatoes, and plum pudding. Enough left over to feed New Year families as selected by the priest. I received an engraved invitation which reads as follows. Major General Sir David Watson, KCB, CNG, and the officers of the 4th Canadian Division request the honor of the company of Lieutenant J.E. Sutton, 8th AFA Brigade, at a ball to be held at the Hotel de Ville, Brussels, on Tuesday, December the 31st, 1918, at 9 p.m. The Hotel de Ville, with its 320-foot spire, is a very beautiful building and dominates the Grand Place, one of the most beautiful public squares in Europe. The grand ballroom on the second floor, facing the public square, has space for an orchestra. Two smaller ballrooms on this floor have space for an orchestra between them. After reception by General Watson and the patronesses, dancing continued till 10:30 p.m., when sword dancing was performed by members of the Scottish regiments. At 11:50 p.m., after more dancing, we gathered in the main ballroom to welcome in the new year. When dancing was resumed, ladies from Brussels, leading families, and some Canadian nurses made excellent partners. Refreshments were available at locations on the second floor. About 2:30 a.m., I left the ballroom with an officer of the 42nd Battalion and joined the celebrants in the street. The mannequin fountain in the grounds of St. Cadillac Cathedral is a bronze statuette of a naked boy who dispenses water from a natural source into a chained metal cup. For this occasion, he had been promoted to a Belgian colonel by the addition of the appropriate petty, and had been connected to a continuous supply of wine, causing considerable congestion in the grounds. After dancing and waiting for about 3 hours, I got a few hours sleep at the Palace Hotel and returned to Great Russia by narrow gauge railway by 3 p.m., January 1, 1919. Life was now very quiet, except for a few diversions. We had ended the war with 4 forces over strength due to picking up 2 cavalry mounts and a non-evacuation of 2 horses wounded by down fragments, but these replacements had been obtained. When it came time to leave, we were 2 horses under strength. Our men engaged in the lead team of B-gun ammunition wagon was taken from the stables, complete with bridles and saddles. They had been heard passing out of town to the west at just after dawn. I was detailed for the job of finding them. Knew that it was an inside job, as the bridles and saddles belonged to these horses. Was accompanied by their driver named Abrams. Finally located them in a stable at a large farmhouse about 2 miles west of town. Was told by the farmer that a soldier sold the horses to him for 400 francs with a tale that they were worn out and unfit for our further use. Recovered horses and took farmer to the gendarme station. He was released and later looked over the assembled battery personnel but did not recognize the man who sold him the horses. He was asked his 400 francs. I suspected that the culprit was driver Abrams. The attacker family had a carriage but no horses. During our stay, driver Rasmussen and his team of watercart mules pulled this carriage to neighboring houses where needed, usually accompanied by mounted officers from the 24th Battery. The 8th Army Brigade had been in existence almost 20 months, most of this time in action, without a chaplain. About New Year's Day, we were assigned one. After sitting around brigade headquarters for about a week, he was told by Colonel Stewart to get out among the other units. This he did by visiting the various officers' messes, but very little attention was given to the men. The end of January, Colonel Stewart handed him a leave warrant to England with orders to report to chaplain's headquarters in London for reassignment. Early in February, a German detail redeemed all German marks at par value. I exchanged some 2,000 marks remaining from those picked up on August 8, 1918, for 2,500 Belgian francs. My only regret was that I had not picked up some rare 1,000 mark notes. We received orders to take inventory of gun stores and men's issued clothing and equipment. There was an almost total shortage on axes, shovels, pickaxes, saws, and hammers. Almost every man was minus his blanket, and some reported no overcoats. We have noted a number of children dressed in woolen garments of the same color as army blankets. Deficiencies in men's equipment were made up with a warning that these were the last they would receive. The flu epidemic, almost general in Europe and America, took its toll. Lost Major Burns, the commanding officer of the 32nd Battery, and some six men from the brigade. The 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Canadian Divisions had been withdrawn from the line and were on their way home. Remaining were the 4th Division, the 5th Division Artillery, the 8th Army Brigade Canadian Field Artillery, and some service units. On February the 16th, we turned over our horses and harness to a Belgian Army detail, and our guns, ammunition, and wagons to the British Army. Left the following morning by train from Wales, arrived at Le Havre on February the 18th. A rail strike in England delayed the departure of the 3rd Division and kept us in camp outside Le Havre until March the 2nd. During this period, our medical and service records were brought up to date as of March the 31st, 1919, and our pay for overseas service stopped as of that date. On March the 2nd, we boarded ship, followed by an infantry battalion. As usual, I had several pet dogs along. These could not pass the military police at the grain tank, so were heaved to some men already on board. Attempts were made to reach these pets, but were met by solid ranks of men. After an hour's delay, we sailed with the pets on board, landed at New Haven on the coast of Sussex, took train to Milford, a short walk to the Buchan. Our baggage followed by truck and was placed in our rooms. I share the room with Captain Wilson of the 32nd Battery. We were both advised that we were to go on a six-day leave next morning and were to attend an investiture at Buckingham Palace at 10:30 a.m. on March the 4th. Next a.m., we checked in at the Canadian Officers Club, got signed up, and arrived at Buckingham Palace on time. When we entered, we checked our hats, canes, and gloves. A hook was fastened to our tunics on which the medal was to be hung. There were more than 80 officers to be decorated, mostly Canadian. The 4th Division had caught up with us and was also at Ribble Cap. Some 6 were to receive the Victoria Cross, England's most coveted honor for both officers and men. Then followed about 24 senior officers, majors and up, to receive the Distinguished Service Order. Finally, about 50 juniors, captains and lieutenants, to receive the Military Cross. We were arranged alphabetically in groups in accordance with the list. Entered a large room in the palace where some spectators were assembled. King George V stood in the far right corner, wearing the uniform of a field marshal, but without a cap, just to eliminate the necessity of saluting. The line followed down the left side of the room and turned right to a point 3 paces from the king. When your name was called, you took the 3 paces forward, stopped in front of the king, who shook your hand and hung your decoration on a hook with a word or so of congratulations or thanks. Stepped back one pace, bowed to the king, turned to the right, and marched out. Pictures were taken in the palace grounds by a press photographer. It was well afternoon when we got out, so I had lunch with Captain Wilson at the Savoy Hotel. Then went to see my sister Abby at the butler's home. I had been unable to get her the previous evening when I had a guest ticket for the investiture. Stayed overnight, and the next day went to Hornbury. Stayed there for 3 days where I said goodbye to my father and other family members. Back in London, I deposited the 2,500 Belgian francs to my account in the Bank of Montreal. Asked for a slight draft for my bills payable to the Bank of Commerce on Yonge Street in Toronto. The clerk asked me to get the manager's okay on this, which I did. The clerk returned with the draft and told me that he had just completed this draft when he was advised that a sum of just over $100 had been deposited to my account from the records office. This was the exact amount of instructor's pay which had been paid to me after I had resigned and had later been deducted from my regular pay. Apparently the pay and records office did not have any other way of closing out my account in England. I immediately cashed a check for this amount. Back to Whitley Camp, where we were given a final medical examination. There I learned that I had missed a trip to Archangel, Russia. The Canadian School of Gunnery was closed, and the personnel were mustered into a brigade of artillery under the command of Colonel Sharman, and with a brigade of Canadian infantry were sent to Archangel in August 1918 to hold this fort open to supply the anti-Bolshevik forces commanded by Kerensky. Some months later, I learned from members of this force that it was almost a comic opera type of war. The Bolsheviks would advance, fire a few rounds, and withdraw when fired on. This force was withdrawn in May 1919. I visited around and said goodbye to friends in and around Guildford. On March the 25th, we went by bus to Godalming Station, where we entrained. Arrived at Liverpool in the early afternoon, where we went on board a small ocean liner named Northland. Had our first and final brigade officer's dinner that evening while tied to the dock. At each place was a copy of a letter headed by the Royal Arms and the address Buckingham Palace. The letter reads as follows. The Queen and I wish you Godspeed and a safe return to your homes and dear ones. The grateful mother country is proud of your extended services characterized by unsurpassed devotion and courage, signed George R.I. These were passed around and signed on the back by the other officers of the brigade. After dinner, a toast to the King was proposed by Colonel Stewart, and as customary, he broke his glass after drinking. The nursing staff from a Canadian field hospital, about 20 nurses and matrons, came aboard that evening. We sailed early on March the 26th. After a very enjoyable and restful crossing, we arrived at Halifax on April the 5th. When landed, we saw some of the damage caused by the explosion of an ammunition ship in the harbor late in 1917. Took the train to Montreal, where most of the brigade detrained. The balance took another train to Toronto. Arrived about midnight. No bands, no reception committee. A very few of us were given a case containing a bronze star with an enclosure which reads as follows. His Majesty has been graciously pleased to authorize the issue of the 1914 star, which I convey to you herewith. Signed, E.O. Ashton, Major General. Officers and men were given 2 months' pay and $150 clothing allowance. Stayed the night at the Prince George Hotel with Ernie Gill and Major Craig. Next morning got measured for 2 suits of clothes and bought other civilian items. Then went to the home of my Aunt Ada in East Toronto. A couple of days later, I got into my new clothes and hung up my uniform. This marks the end of my wartime experiences. When the Canadian militia was reorganized in 1921, I received a permanent commission as lieutenant or other higher rank, and was assigned to the 9th Battery Canadian Fusiliers. Major McNair was in command of the 9th Battery. He had been my section commander in 1914. Captain Higgins was a replacement officer who came to us at Pigstead in 1916. The three section commanders were recent graduates from the Royal Military College at Kingston, Ontario. The battery was equipped with six 4.5-inch howitzers, and we occupied our original quarters in the armories on University Avenue. I received a uniform allowance of $100 to replace worn-out wartime items. Drill was for 2 hours, one evening per week, for 8 months each year. For 2 weeks, at camp for maneuvers and foreign courses. The men received a dollar for each drill evening and a dollar and a half a day while at camp. Officers were only paid while in camp. Foreign courses was a total overtime, most of all the year. Guns, horses, and drivers were furnished by the Royal Canadian Horse Artillery. This was okay while I was working in
Friday, but when I went out on construction of roads and bridges, of officers. This was put through just after my promotion to captain. Finally, when I was not needed during World War II, as I was married and was working for the DuPont Company, I took out American citizenship papers, which canceled out my peacetime Canadian Army connection.